You know, for the last month or two, I've given messages, you've done your own Bible studies, all on the Passover, preparing ourselves for the Passover, you know, preparing ourselves for unleavened bread, getting the sin out of our lives. I've asked you over the last week to really pray every day when you got up, to ask God to show you still where those areas of sin might be hiding in your life. And you might think, well, you know, we're at the end of unleavened bread now. We can focus on something else. Well, I'm going to suggest to you that we continue to focus on it, but I'm going to give you today some points that may seem a little lighthearted as far as the points that I'll give you, but there's a lot deeper meaning to them. I used to subscribe several years ago to different newsletters, and a few years ago I received one. And in it was a list entitled, Noah's 10 Lessons. And you might have read that at some point. But I found the points were really worth pondering. And I want to share with you today the top 10 lessons from Noah's Ark. And as I said, they're a little lighthearted, the lessons, the points themselves. But they're pretty deep when we get to thinking about them. We'll get into those a little bit. But we can start by just turning over to Genesis 6. I want to do a little review before we get into the top 10 lessons from Noah's Ark. The story of Noah's Ark is one that most of us have probably known since children. My parents didn't attend church, but I remember at a doctor's office one time, they used to have these children's illustrated Bibles. I don't know if you ever saw them in doctor's offices. But I vividly remember what Adam and Eve looked like based upon that little painting they had. You know, they took some liberties, obviously, but it stuck with me. And what they don't know, the authors of that, is that as they told the story of Adam and Eve, it helped me as a youngster really get into it and understand it. You know, I can remember the picture of the serpent coming down the tree and wrapping himself around the apple. It made it real to me. And the same was with Noah's Ark. I remember that. I still remember the picture that they had of Noah's Ark perched on this little mound. And far as you could see off in the horizon, there were animals marching orderly, you know, two by two. And it made that story real to me. But I want to spend a little time reviewing it just briefly. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 6. Today, that's where we're going to start talking about the story of Noah. And again, I want to review this story before we get to the 10 points. As we know in Genesis 6, basically verses 1 through 5, God talks about, at that point, about seeing the wickedness in man. And in verse 6, he states something that I can't imagine what he was feeling when he stated that in verse 6 of Genesis 6. I'll read that. It says, "And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." I can't imagine, again, what he was feeling when he said he was sorry. He was sorry that he had made man, that he was grieved in his heart. I mean, try to put yourself in God's position at that point. Verse 7, he vowed to destroy man from the face of the earth, right? Verse 8, just to review a few things here, we see Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 9 talks about the genealogy. This is the genealogy of Noah. It tells us Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. We can read that Noah walked with God. Verse 10, we can see Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And I think about today's world. That could describe what we're seeing today. Right? How much worse, or was it even worse then? Again, verse 12, God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. In verse 13, we can see God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth." Then he gets into verses 14, starting in verse 14, he gets into how he wants them to make it, what he's supposed to make it with, how big it's supposed to be, how long, how tall, how wide, what the second, third decks are supposed to look like. Right? He told Noah exactly how he wanted it and exactly what he wanted. Again, he's saying, just do as I say. Verse 17, "And behind myself am bringing floodwaters to the earth to destroy from under heavens, which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die." He goes on then, "I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you and your sons and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark and keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." Verse 20, "Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them." Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. We're going to come back as we go through this and talk about a few more of these scriptures here. But understand, as we read here through verse 22, it says, "Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did." But he picked him anyway because he was a just man. And God had just laid out this enormous task before him. And instead of saying, "God, what are you talking about? I live in this arid environment. You expect me to build a big ship like this? That's a lot." But it says he didn't do that. It says he did it. He did it according to what God commanded him. Briefly in chapter 7, again as an overview, in verse 2, we see that Noah is told to bring 7 pair of clean animals. We know that. 1 pair of unclean animals. Verse 3, 7 pair of each bird. Verse 4 and 5, he tells them, now it's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And that he's going to destroy all living things. Verse 6, we'll come back to this later, but Noah was 600 years old when the flood happened. Again, we'll talk about that more. Verses 7 through 10 of chapter 7, Noah again does what God says. He takes his family into the ark. He follows God's directions. Verses 11 and 12, we see that the flood starts. And just as God had said, it lasted for 40 days. It rained 40 days and 40 nights. In verse 20, he tries to describe the overwhelming depth of the water. He says, "The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered." Now think about that. The mountains were covered. Again, that's hard to fathom today. Verses 21 through 23, it tells us that everything not on the ark dies. We know that. And then in verse 24, "The waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Now if we go on to chapter 8, verses 2 and 3, it talks about that time when the waters then start to begin to recede. And in verse 5, we see that finally now they can see the very tops of the mountains are exposed. Verses 7 through 12, we see the process start of first sending out a raven, then sending out a series of doves to bring back evidence, you know, of dry land. And I can, in that Children's Illustrated Bible, I can picture that dove holding that little bitty olive branch as he's sitting on there. Verses 13 and 14, "The earth dried and the ark was opened up," and we know the rest from there. Right? We know from there the survivors, both man and animal, were told that they were to scatter and that they were to be fruitful and that they were to multiply. And we know that's what happened. Now, we could spend time going through each verse and find many, many countless lessons that we could learn from the story, but I want to over this story in a little bit different way today. I'm going to give you the top 10 lessons from Noah. The number one lesson from Noah, and it's simply plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, if you will be a great place to start as we build our case to support, this first lesson. Proverbs 6, starting in verse 6, my point, simply plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. We just all know in our lives, as a general, that planning ahead is good advice for all of us. And we know that we shouldn't procrastinate, wait till the last minute to do something. But in Proverbs 6, verse 6, we're told that we should look to the ant. We're familiar with these scriptures. To look to the ant for inspiration, right? As an example of how we should prepare for the future. Proverbs 6, starting in verse 6. It says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise." Verse 7, "Which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep?" Verse 10, "A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep." Verse 11, "So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." We understand, brethren, that we are to be prepared, both physically and spiritually, for when the trials come, because as sure as rain, they're going to come. Right? We can't wait until it's here and say, "Oh boy, now what do I do? I should have thought about this. I should have prepared better." Every day that we live, we are getting closer to the end times. And I'm not here to say they're going to happen next week, next month, next year, the next 5 years. We don't know. Only God does. We can speculate about that all day long as to how soon that will be. But we don't know. Only God knows. And we understand now, brethren, that this is our time. This is our proving grounds. This is our time to prepare for the end times and to do our best every day to live a life pleasing to God. We know that that's what we're supposed to be doing. To grow closer to Him now, because as the lesson says, the first number one lesson said, it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Again, he planned for it, and we need to do the same. Let's turn to Luke chapter 17. Luke 17, if you would please. Luke, as we turn over here, Luke 17 kind of reminds me of today, of the world that we live in today, I should say. Luke 17, verses 26 and 27. Right? If we understand what it was like in the days of Noah, that God had just had it. Luke 17, verses 26 and 27 says that as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. So what was it like back in Noah's time? Remember what we read in Genesis 6, verse 11, where it said, "The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence." Again, doesn't that sound very familiar? Right? He's talking about Noah's time here. Genesis 6, verse 11, verse 12, we touched on it earlier. Remember, it said, "God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, 'The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth.'" Again, I asked myself as I was reviewing this, when I reread this story, I asked myself at times, was he more disgusted, God, with the way it was then than possibly the way it is now? We don't know. I can't answer that. You know, but most of the times when I read the scriptures comparing society's condition prior to the return of Christ, I think of the condition of the world itself. I think about that for a minute. We need to consider, again, what it was like during this time of Noah. Right? God knew that he was going to protect Noah, even though he was going to destroy the world. Brethren, that's what he's planning for us. That's what he's planning for us. He's going to save us. Genesis 6, verse 14. Again, we glossed over this earlier, but here God's giving Noah specific instructions. He tells him, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Right? He told him, I want it to be this long, I want it to be this tall, I want it to be this wide. I want you to put a window in here, and I want you to put pitch there, and put pitch here. And Noah did exactly what God asked him to do. Right? Verse 22 again. Thus Noah did according to all God commanded him, so he did. And so maybe I would ask at this time, are we all now building our own spiritual ark? Are we building our own spiritual ark today for the storms that we know are coming? Again, God has told us basically the same thing he told Noah. We can read it in our Bibles. He said, there's storms are coming and it's going to be bad. And he's given us very specific, detailed instructions on what we're supposed to do, right? How we're supposed to live. And how are we to treat others? How we should obey him. And the question that I have for myself, and I'll ask you, is are we doing as Noah did in verse 22, where it says, Noah did according to all that God commanded him? Or do we compromise? You know, are we ever doing that? Are we saying, God, you know, are you sure we want to do that? Like, go for wood, because that's hard. That's hard to work with. Maybe we could use pine. You know, a little easier to work with. And putting pitch on the outside and the inside is going to be a mess on the inside. Maybe just the outside would probably be good enough. You know, we're trying to compromise. We just put a little pitch on the outside. That should hold the water out. Let me ask you again, if God's spiritual instruction to us were like the plans for building the ark, would your spiritual ark float when it was done? Are we following God's plan for each of us? Or are we taking shortcuts? Point number one, again, the top 10 lessons from Noah is plan ahead, because it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Point number two, simply stay fit. When you're 600 years old, someone might ask you to do something really big. Well, part of what I'm saying with that is you're never, ever too old to be of service to God. We understand that. We know that we have to make efforts to remain physically and spiritually healthy so that we are ready when God calls on us. You know, and even when we account for the length of time that people lived before the flood, we have to understand Noah was well into middle age at 600 years old. Right? Something I never realized. Look back to Genesis 6 again, this time verse 3. I guess I realize this, but it came out again. Genesis 6, again, a point that we should just touch on. Genesis 6, verse 3, it says, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever. He is indeed flesh, and his days shall be 120 years." Again, so we know before the flood, people lived a long time. But God's saying from this point on, he's going to allow people 120 years to change their ways. And while he doesn't say it specifically, there are many commentaries that say that this is the point at which Noah started the ark. Verse 6. Noah was 600 years old when the floods of the water came upon the earth. So if we take a step back, do a little math, that makes Noah about 480 years old when he started building the ark. Right? If we jump back again, just to put things in context, that you're never too old to serve God, you know, look at Genesis 5, verse 32. How old was Noah when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth? Genesis 5, verse 32. And Noah was 500 years old. And Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 500 years old. Now again, understand, at this time, most people had had their children in their mid to late 100s. Think about it. Right? Mid to late 100s. They were spring chickens yet at that time. Right? Noah was 500 years old, it tells us, when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then again in verse 18, you know, we'll see where God talked to Noah. At this point, he may have never thought he was going to have children, but God had other plans. He told him in Genesis 6, verse 18, he says, "I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons' wives, and you." He's probably waiting for God to finish talking at this point, but he's thinking, does he not realize I'm 480 years old? I don't have sons. I don't have daughter-in-laws. But he had something to look forward to, right? To add to this point, you know, I need to say also that you're also never too young to serve God and to do God's work either. Think about it. Noah's sons weren't born until he'd been working on the ark for about 20 years. And as his sons grew, I'm sure they helped him as soon as they were able, following God's directions specifically. So, point two, you're never too old or too young to do God's work. The third lesson that I learned from Noah is simply this. Don't listen to the critics. Do what has to be done. Brethren, if we think about it, God has given each of us a very special calling, and we need to make sure that we don't let anyone or anything divert us from our own, again, individual calling. As I think about with Noah, as I apply this to Noah, and think about back to that time, that 120-ish years he spent building the ark, and I know that he had to endure his share of ridicule along the way. People walking by and say, "Hey, crazy old man, what are you building a boat in the desert for?" Right? Year after year, right? They kept doing this. And I'm sure they were making fun of him, but it doesn't appear that he swerved at all from his calling. What about you and I, brethren? How many times have we been possibly ridiculed or looked down upon at some point for our beliefs, right, for doing the right thing? So even today, you know, moved into this new area, I've met a lot of different people, and of course, you hear all the questions, "You don't keep Christmas? Why don't you keep Christmas? You don't keep Happy Easter? Where are you going to services?" I'm like, I'm not, you know. "You're a terrible heathen," and he's telling me, "you're not, you know, going to Easter." but you try to explain to them, and some people will say okay, some people just look at you blankly, walk away, some people probably want to hit you with a big stick, you know, but there's a lot of people that just can't accept what we believe. God hasn't called them yet. And they probably do ridicule us, you know, behind our backs. But again, think about Noah. In 120 years, he endured that, and he continues to do everything just as God had instructed him. Living up in Wisconsin for so many years, we were neighboring states with Minnesota. And I don't know if you guys remember Minnesota's famous governor, Jesse the Body Ventura. He's a former wrestler, smarter than he looked, you know, as he tried to be governor. But Jesse Ventura once said this in a televised TV interview. He said, "Organized religion is a sham and a crutch for weak-minded people who need strength in numbers." It was on national TV. He was being interviewed by Bill Maher, who I don't think a lot of at the time, or still don't. But they said, both of them, people have organized religion and are just leaning on it as a crutch. But that isn't what God says, is it? God says, don't listen to the critics. This is the way to live, just as I've outlined it here. This is what you have to do. Turn over to 1 Corinthians, please. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. See, God has called us now, and we can try to fool ourselves, but we know exactly what we're supposed to be doing. Now, whether we do it or not every day is can be a challenge. But we know exactly what we are to do. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, let's start in verse 22. It says, "For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." Verse 25, "Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." Verse 26, "For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But," he says in verse 27, "God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world, and the things which are despised, God has chosen. And the things which are not, to bring nothing to those to the things that are." Verse 29, "That no flesh should glory in his presence, but of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption." Finally, verse 31, "That it is written, he who glories, let him glory in the Lord." We know this. We've been taught this for all the time we've been in the church. Right? God has called, and he's selected, and he's personally handpicked you and I for whatever reason he knows. Why us? Why now? You know, it talks about here how he picks the weak and the base things. But he has picked us. We need to remember that God has picked us, and he's given us very specific, detailed instructions, which aren't hard to understand. God says, don't listen to the critics. Right? Do what has to be done. This is what you need to do. He says, it's not a secret. It's hidden. It's not hidden. Fourth point today from the lessons of Noah. It's simply, build on high ground. Fourth point is simply build on high ground. Each of us, we know, have faced, we will face many floods, and we need to make sure that we stay out of the floodplains. I think back to where Brenda and I were from in Illinois. I remember year after year after year, all the 30-some years we lived there, along the Mississippi River and along the Spoon River, there'd be just terrible, devastating floods. And it's just bad. And we'd have these big floods, and you'd read story about people who were enduring the same flood. They lost their properties, their houses, for the second, the third, the fourth. I remember a 15th time having their homes flooded. And at that point, when I was down there, I'd think, why don't they just move? It's like if I lived in, what's that state in New York that gets all the snow? Or that city in New York? Buffalo. I didn't want to live in Buffalo. I would move, right? But these people will be flooded year after year, and I think, why don't they just move? Why keep doing this? Because you know it's going to happen again. I understand might not be as easy just to move as it seems, but you'd think they'd learn the first time and they wouldn't live there if they kept coming back. Brethren, like them, we need to stay out of the floodplains. Right? Stay out of those areas and build our spiritual house on a foundation. Right? We know that. Christ told us that if we do that, we should be able to withstand anything that comes, any storm that comes along, if we follow Him and if we follow the directions that He's given us. Matthew 7, verse 24, let's turn there. It talks about this. It talks about building on a rock, right? Building on high ground, and how that's going to help us. Matthew 7, let's start in verse 24. It says, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, right? That's the key part of this. Who hears and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on a rock, and the rain descended, the floods came, and the wind blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Verse 26, but everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house in the sand. Okay, so that's like the guy who keeps building his house along in the floodplains along the Mississippi River. He's just asking for trouble. So but everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. There's nothing new here. We've been told this as long as we've been in the church. It's not a surprise. The question is, are we doing it? Are we building our foundation on high ground? Are we building our foundation on a rock? Because just like it describes here in Matthew 7, we do that. We build on high ground. We build on the rock so that no matter what happens, we can look at all the problems going on around us, all the turmoil going on, and we can't let that affect us. Right? I gave a sermon, two-part sermon, in the last couple months where we talked about the need to work out our own salvation. We understand that. That's who we are. So let's make sure that if we haven't yet built on high ground, let's move there now and start that foundation. Point number five from the lessons of Noah. Speed isn't always an advantage. The cheetahs were on board, but so were the snails. The cheetahs were on board, but so were the snails. Right? Speed isn't always an advantage. You know, think about it. We think about the race we run. We all are running the same race. So we talked about our exit, you know. We're going to the same exit, the same place. We all are running the same race. Some might run faster than others, but the most important thing is to finish. It's to not stop. It's an endurance race. We've talked about that in the past. It's a marathon. Hebrews chapter 12. Again, there's nothing new. We know these scriptures very well. Hebrews 12. But it's something we know, but it's, again, a good reminder. And this point five, again, as I said, well, speed isn't always an advantage. It really applies here. Hebrews 12, verse 1. Says, therefore also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And here's the important part. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. As I mentioned, this is an endurance race. We can't, well, all of us probably did when we were first called. We had all this zeal. We couldn't read everything and we just couldn't get enough of it. But we can't start fast with lots of zeal and then fizzle. Say, I'm just too tired to do this anymore. Right? We can't allow us to lose our energy. We understand that our race is an endurance race, that it requires steady, constant, forward motion. We really can't even afford to just sit still, you know, and say, oh God, just keep going, I'm resting now. We can't, because if we're not moving ahead, we're losing ground. And we can't allow that. Point number six that I'll share with you today from the lessons of Noah is, for safety's sake, travel in pairs. Two heads are better than one. Took back to Ecclesiastes, chapter 4, please. Ecclesiastes, chapter 4. We're going to see here in Ecclesiastes where Solomon is talking about the importance of friendship and how one can strengthen each other in times of need. And he talks about the need for us to strive to build good, solid friendships, good, solid relationships. And we talked about that quite a bit in the last 6 months in Richmond, so that we can help each other. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, let's start here in verse 8. It says in verse 8 of Ecclesiastes 4, there is one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor daughter, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toll and deprive myself of good? Says, this is also vanity and a great misfortune. Verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Verse 11, and if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Verse 12, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and threefold cord is not quickly broken. And what I'm saying here, simply saying, is that we need each other. We need each other. We need to take advantage of the time that we have together on the Sabbath, but not just on that, at that time. That we understand, we need to stay in contact with each other because in today's world, we're so spread out. But we need each other to support each other, to lift each other up, to exhort each other. And we cannot, brethren, we cannot overlook the value of staying close to each other. Because if you consider this, we're all we really have in this world, right, is each other, and we need each other. Point number 7 from the lessons of Noah is simply this. Don't forget that we're all in the same boat. Don't forget that we're all in the same boat. And I think that's something we should remember at all levels of our relationship, whether it's marriage, whether it's family, whether it's the local congregation, whether it's the church as a whole. We can accomplish a lot more if we are all rowing in the same direction, all working as a team. Satan is always after us, right? Especially before Passover, there was a lot of people going on in people's lives. Satan is working hard on us. He's working hard today on God's church. And it appears right at times in God's church that we're not all willing to be in the same boat. We've seen it in the past. It'll happen again. And it's very troubling when it happens, as we see individuals, as we as individuals need to make sure that we don't get fooled or don't get sidetracked or start following a man. Right? We follow God. Every one of us in this room know what God expects of us as individuals. And again, if everyone in God's church adhere to this principle that we're all in the same boat, that we are all trying to get to the same place, to get off at the same exit. If we all remembered that and adhered to that principle, things would be different. But God doesn't say it's going to be that way. He says there will be tares among us to the end. So we challenge each other to make sure that none of us are tares. If we start acting like one, we get our attention so that we won't be. But remember again, brethren, point 7 is don't forget that we are all in the same boat. Point number 8 of the top 10 lessons from Noah is remember that amateurs built the ark and professionals built the Titanic. I like that different point. I gave this up in Wisconsin a few years ago, and one of the men said, if you knew him, he offered his opinion a lot. I said that, and he goes, oh no, the head architect of the Ark project was God, and he was a professional. Okay. But there are two things I want to point out from this, this statement. Remember that amateurs built the Ark and professionals built the Titanic. Number one is that we need not be intimidated from not accomplishing what God has set before us. You cut out the double negatives. We should not be intimidated by what God has set out before us. Because as it tells us, Scripture, if God is for us, who can be against us? We know that scripture. And point number 2 under this 8th point of mine is remember that verse that we read earlier in 1 Corinthians 1:27, where it told us that God has chosen the foolish of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. You know, as I consider again my point here about that amateurs built the Ark and professionals built the Titanic, I have this little side story, a little information I'll share with you. If you've studied history, some of us have, the Titanic was constructed, we know, in Belfast, Ireland, by the building firm Harland and Wolff, and she was the technical marvel of the Edwardian period, built and finished within 3 years. And that amateur Noah took like 40 times that, 120 years. Right? The Titanic, as I'll read to you here, had double bottoms and 16 compartments formed by 15 watertight bulkheads running across the ship's hull. In an account of these safe features, a phrase was often repeated by Bruce Ismay. He was the president of the White Star Line. Just as the Titanic was setting sail from Southampton, Bruce Ismay said, and pointed to his ship, God himself couldn't sink that ship. Now, my little feeble mind, I have to wonder if God's not sitting up there going, oh, not putting thoughts in God's mind, but that's how I think. But again, point eight, amateurs built the Ark, professionals built the Titanic. My point to this was, we cannot allow ourselves to be intimidated forever from doing the work of God. And the work that God has put before us, even though it tells us in 1 Corinthians 1:27 that he's called the weak and foolish of the world. Because we do win. In the end, we will prevail. How about point number nine? Point number nine is simply this. Remember that the woodpeckers inside the ship are often the bigger threat than the storm outside. Let me explain. It is a fact that a small hole can sink a big ship if it's not repaired. What I mean by that, my point here is that we need to look at ourselves every day, our spiritual ark that I spoke of, and examine ourselves to make sure that our spiritual ship hasn't sprung a leak. Even a tiny little leak. We have to fix it if we find that. We have to strive to eliminate any weaknesses that could cause a fatal error. And we read back in Genesis 6, verse 14, what God instructed him. I'll read it to you again. He says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. Now, I want to digress slightly because this is very interesting to me. If you look at Genesis 6, 14, if you want to turn there again, you can. I'll wait on you if you want to turn back. Genesis 6, verse 14. So you see at the end of verse 14 where he talks about the first time he mentions the word pitch here in Genesis 6, 14. That's Strong's number 3732. And it refers to the word kaphar, K-A-P-H-A-R. And it means, literally, to cover. In some places it means to cover completely. But it also means, bear with me here, it also means to make an atonement for, which is another way that the word is used. Right? And this, to figuratively use it, to appease, it says, to atone, to purge, to reconcile. Now the second time the word pitch is used in Genesis 6, 14, it's a different word. Right? It's Strong's number 3724, and it's kopher, K-O-P-H-E-R. And in this case it means as a ransom, as a satisfaction, as a price for your life. Now, if we just briefly consider this, I think about that, about what the literal and the figurative meanings are there. Okay, and as I read this, I see just as the pitch made the ark watertight, these two different words, these two different uses of the word are a picture of Christ. Right? First of all, Christ as our atonement, as it's talking about how the pitch is used inside the person, right, or inside the vessel, and on the outside, Christ is our redemption. Right? We know that the ark, The people in the ark were saved because of the pitch protected them from the death outside. And so too, those people in Christ are protected. And finally, you're probably saying, the last point I want to share to you, I think maybe the most important of all, of the top 10 lessons from Noah. And it's simply this. No matter how bleak it looks, if God is with you, there's always a rainbow on the other side. As I put myself, or try to put myself in Noah's position, I sometimes wonder if he ever worried during that flood. You know, I'm guessing those 40 days and nights of rain were nerve-wracking, and then it was, what did we read, another 150 days before the water even started to recede. And I asked myself, knowing that, I mean, Noah, probably more converted than I am, did he ever have a doubt? We won't know. We don't know. But was there ever a worry in his mind during that time? You know, we need to remember as we ponder on this story of Noah, that no matter how fierce the storms are, no matter how long the storm rages, God tells us that he will deliver us. We know it might not be in this life, this temporary physical life, but he does promise us he will deliver us. And I just have to think that some point during that flood, that Noah's hope had to be tried a little bit. But like Noah, he finished the job. And so we need to keep our hope in God, because again, no matter how bleak it looks, if God is there, if God is with you, as the point said, there's always a rainbow on the other side. So again, I know that the points were a little humorous. There is the depth behind them. As we go forward out of these days of unleavened bread, what do we need to do? These are some things we can focus on and think about. I think they're worth remembering. But we do need, brethren, to prepare now for those storms that are coming. And we need to remember that no matter how bad the storm is, no matter how fierce it becomes, that if we build our house on high ground, if we build our spiritual ark to the very specifications that God has given us, that we will remain safe and God will deliver us.